Enchaîner tout de suite avec la prochaine session et je vais vous présenter l'animatrice. Sharon Genette is Senior Fellow at the Center on Governance at the University of Ottawa. She's very well known in the field of city studies, urban studies. From 2005 to 2007, she was Senior Advisor to the Canadian Cultural Observatory in the Department of Canadian Heritage. Before that, she was Manager of International Comparative Research in the Department's Strategic Research and Analysis Directorate. She's the author of many, many articles, and she's the co-editor of a book with Carolyn Andrew, Monica Gattinger, and somebody named Will Straw called Accounting for Culture, Thinking Through Cultural Citizenship. So Sharon, I'll ask you to introduce and chair the next panel.
Well, thank you, Will. I'm really pleased to be here today to moderate this panel. We've heard something about voting as an element of urban citizenship, and now we're going to talk a little bit more about urban citizenship in broader terms. And we have four people with us today who are some of the best qualified in Canada to do that. So let's get started. I'm going to first introduce them and then invite them each to come here and make the presentation. Then we'll go to the armchair discussion, and I hope we'll have some time for questions at the end. We're running a little late, so lunch is moved back 15 minutes, but we'll try and respect that timetable. So I'll start with the first presenter, who's going to be Jane Engel. Jane is the National Curator for Cities for People, and that's an urban innovation network that aims to create more resilient and livable cities. And she's going to tell us more about that in her presentation. So I'll just say briefly that she's practiced participatory urban planning and development in many countries and contexts. She was the co-convener of the EcoCity World Summit held in 2011 in Montreal, and perhaps some of you were there. She's currently a PhD candidate at McGill, the McGill University School of Planning, to be exact. And she holds a Master of Urban and Regional Planning and an MBA as a city planner and is certified in the U.S. and Canada. The next presenter will be Nicole Swearhun. Nicole is the founding principal of Swearhun Facilitation. It's based out of the Center on Social Innovation in Toronto. And this firm has a really interesting mandate, dedicated to making complex, often controversial, and high-profile multi-stakeholder projects constructive and manageable. And that we got to hear about. She's done, the team that she works with has completed over 200 projects. Some of them include projects in post-war Bosnia, which must have been a challenge, in post-Katrina New Orleans, and in cities across Canada and the U.S. The firm's most recent work has focused on engaging the public in discussions regarding the role of governments in evaluating proposed private sector investments. And some examples include the TransCanada's proposed investment in the Energy East pipeline and Porter Airlines' interest in expanding their operations on the Toronto waterfront. So I hope she'll tell us a little bit more about that. Nicole is a senior associate of the Canadian Urban Institute. Now, moving on to Denise Belkacin, who's a very celebrated journalist. I was very interested to read in her biography. She's won a National Magazine Award for her work with The Grid. She's been nominated multiple times for her work with Toronto Life. She currently writes for the Globe and Mail, and she appears regularly as a commentator on CBC Radio. She's also co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Ethnic Isle, a digital magazine about race and ethnicity in the Greater Toronto area. And finally, last but not least, Senator Larry Campbell, whom many of you know. He's had many high-profile jobs during his career. I understand he began as a policeman, and he's moved up from there to become a senior, the chief coroner for British Columbia. And his work in that post served as an inspiration for the show Da Vinci's Inquest, which some of you may have seen. In 2002, he was elected mayor of Vancouver. on a platform that included the Four Pillars approach to ending drug abuse. And during his time as mayor, he spearheaded the approval and establishment of North America's first legal safe injection site. In addition, he was also instrumental in the successful Vancouver bid for the 2010 Winter Olympic and Paralympic Games. And to top that off, in 2005, he was summoned to the Senate of Canada, where he has continued his work on drug policy, mental health, and Aboriginal issues. He's currently a member of the Senate Standing Senate Committee on Internal Economy, Budgets, and Administration, which must be a really interesting job these days, and the Standing Senate Committee on Banking, Trade, and Commerce. So, each panelist is now going to give us each a short presentation. We were told 5 to 8 minutes, so we'll try and do that. And after that, we'll have a discussion. So may I invite Jane to the podium first?
Bonjour tout le monde. Thank you, Sharon. Ça me fait un grand plaisir d'être parmi vous aujourd'hui. And I want to thank Will and congratulate Will and the whole organizing team for putting together a super interesting conference and really a great group of people. And I'm honored and also humbled to be part of this panel. It's really great to meet you all. So I'm very proud to be a Montrealer. I adopted this city 12 years ago, so I welcome you all if you're not from here. But even my Francophone friends in the room will be happy to hear me speak English today. So this panel is on urban citizenship, and so for Cities for People, which is, as Sharon mentioned, it's a collaborative experiment in making better cities. And it's an experiment initiated by the J.W. McConnell Family Foundation, which is based here in Montreal. Our main constituency, or our main audience for our Cities for People website, are engaged and interested urban citizens. So I wanted to start off my presentation with a short 2-minute video of our Cities for People introduction video. So would you please play that first video?
For every city, I want them to be in a situation where the citizens can say, today, this city is a little bit better than yesterday.
Can you make it full screen, please?
We have become an urban species. Over half the world's population, and close to 80% of Canadians, live in cities. Society and the global environment are changing. The cities we live in today could much better reflect our needs and our aspirations. People are hungry for change.
Cities for People are really about resilience and livability. By resilience, we mean adaptive, we mean designed for the long term, able to withstand shocks and keep going. And by livable, we mean equitable, enjoyable for everybody, not just for people who have economic means, but that create the conditions for everyone in society to enjoy life, to participate in public spaces, to be part of decision making, and to feel like, you know, they are in fact regarded as citizens.
Cities for People are places where the agencies of all people are taken seriously.
Cities for People are also cities for nature, the low carbon cities, places where we grow food and consume it together. Cities for People are ready for the changes that are coming as a result of climate and are adapting to it.
And we are talking about good urban habitat for Homo sapiens.
We want cities for people. What about you?
Okay,
So our starting point for Cities for People was the question, how can we enhance social, ecological, and economic well-being and help civic cultures thrive? And you might call it our theory of change, or our core proposition was that cities could be made better in three particular ways, was how we approached it. So by creating and building urban innovation networks, by fostering a culture of experimentation, something that the last panel talked quite a bit about, particularly Talia and Adam, and also by contributing to new narratives of what cities can be. So first of those, urban innovation networks. So we recognize that there are already so many innovative, interesting examples in cities in Canada and around the world, but that they're not connected up in ways that are really adding up to more than the sum of their parts. We're not really moving the needle enough in creating much better cities. And so the way we designed our Cities for People structure, our platform, was as a platform of what we call curators. And we have curators for four particular themes: for art and society, new economies, cityscapes, and citizen spaces. And the art and society curator is Musa Geddes, based in Guelph. New economies curator is One Earth, based in Vancouver. The Citizen Spaces curator is Le Centre d'écologie urbaine de Montréal, so the Montreal Urban Ecology Centre, based here in Montreal. And the Cityscapes curator is Evergreen City Works, which is based in Toronto. And I might add that that two of those curators are here today, so if you want to talk to them later, they're available. And so we also have recently set up a new network of Cities for People conveners across the country. We have six so far, and we're about to add three more, including here in Quebec. And this is supported by a national curation team, of which I'm a part. So we're kind of the not-so-sticky glue that holds all of this together. So our network, as you can see, it's geographically spread across the country. We engage multiple sectors and disciplines. This is partners in Canada, but we also have partners in the U.S., in the U.S. and beyond, including the Young Foundation, who's also here today, and who Gorka Espio, our colleague, will be giving a presentation this afternoon. So the second thing is fostering a culture of experimentation. So we've really aimed to shake up the usual way of doing things and to open up pathways for systemic change. So we're testing approaches that are promising through dozens of demonstration projects across the country and supporting ones beyond that from national initiatives, including something called We Are Cities, which I'll talk about at the end in a couple of minutes, to granular projects in neighborhoods, and to also what Jaime Lerner refers to as urban acupuncture projects. So I wanted to give one example of this kind of project, and that is called Transforme ta ville. And it's initiated by our curator, Le Centre d'écologie urbaine de Montréal. And it's basically a call for citizens to present projects that would make their neighborhoods better. So these are quick, collaborative neighborhood practical projects that might be anything from public art to street animation, urban agriculture, that sort of thing. And it's in its second round of funding, which just ended last week. They had 71 projects submitted, and they've put together really a stellar jury. In fact, I think a couple of people in that jury are in the room today, and they'll be meeting next week to decide the winners for that project. And what's interesting about it is that they're also establishing networks of people who are submitting projects so that they can learn from each other and further build on what they're learning and what they're doing in neighborhoods. And then the third thing is that we're aiming to contribute to new narratives about what cities can be. So we believe that people can and should expect more from their cities, and that they also desire to contribute more to their cities. So this is a way of people seeing themselves in terms of urban citizenship as producers rather than consumers of cities. And we're talking about really raising expectations about what cities can be. So to adopt the phrase from a very successful global movement about another world is possible, well, also another city is possible, right? So we aim to contribute to that movement to create better cities.
So to do that, we've made visible or connected a number of innovations across the country, and we're trying to raise the profile of those. And we do that through our website. We also do it through means like Spacing Magazine, who is our communications partner. And if you haven't already picked one up, we have a Cities for People special issue, which they're out on the table. We have lots in English and French, so feel free to take one or even take a handful and share them with your friends and colleagues. And we also have a number of partnerships and are rapidly becoming a network of networks across the country. So where are we headed? As I mentioned, we're an experiment, and it's a short-term experiment. So we end in June of this year, so we're just a few more months in this phase. So we're currently in the process of capturing the learning of the past year and then working to develop plans for what's ahead. So I wanted to close by sharing a brand new initiative that we have called We Are Cities, or La Ville, C'est Nous. And the idea is to harness what we believe is a collective energy and a collective desire to work together to stand up for our cities. And so the We Are Cities campaign is stewarded by Evergreen CityWorks, our curator in Toronto, but it's actually a national initiative. So it's an invitation specifically to create a new vision for Canada and an action plan to help us get there. And it's an invitation to all Canadians to engage, including you. So I'd like to ask, please, if you would show the second video, and I'll close with this.
As you all know, Canada has some of the most beautiful cities in the world. Very workable, very livable. But we know there's problems under the surface. More than 80% of Canadians now live in our urban areas, and cities are a critical component to our economic and social prosperity. So we need to protect our cities, we need to build better cities, and we need to stand up for our cities. So We Are Cities is a new campaign that we're launching with a number of organizations to engage Canadians in the future of our cities.
This is an action plan for Canadian cities. And this is an action plan that we actually can't build without your help.
So we ask you today to join us, give your ideas, get engaged in the conversation, and then let's push decision makers to give our cities the tools they need to thrive in the 21st century.
The easiest way to join the We Are Cities conversation is to submit an idea or reflect on an existing idea that's already posted on our website. Another way to get involved in the We Are Cities campaign is to host a roundtable. A roundtable is really simple. It's a conversation with your community in your city. If you're interested in participating in a roundtable, go to wearecities.ca and see if your city is already listed on the map. If it's not, you're welcome to host one. Start your own roundtable. All the resources you need are online, including how to invite people, including how to host, and including also how to share your ideas back with the We Are Cities campaign. And so all of the ideas and actions that you generate in the roundtables will go directly into informing a national action plan for cities in Canada.
So together we can build a vision of the cities we want and implement a plan on how to get there.
Join the conversation at wearecities.ca.
Let's stand up for our cities.
Merci. En terminant, je mentionnerai que on vient de lancer le site web en français aussi, c'est lavillecenu.ca. Donc je vous invite à s'engager. Merci.
Thanks for having me, thanks to Will and Dadson in particular. Je veux parler en français, mais j'apprends français maintenant. Alors, si je parle français, c'est un grand problème pour toutes. So I'm going to talk in English, and I would love to come back one day when French is much easier for me. It's a real pleasure to be here and echo Jane's comments, particularly with the folks on this panel. So we're a little organization. We get hired by governments to help them to connect to the constituencies they serve. So we only work for governments. We also work for public agencies and occasionally nonprofits. And that's the lens through which I'm going to speak today. We know that maybe half of the people in Toronto voted, not in the last election, well, probably just over half, but any election, maybe half the people vote.
Less than half of those end up electing the leader. And then you're the leader and you have to lead on behalf of 100%,
not the 25% that voted for you. And so we're very interested in how democracy works in between elections and what steps do you take in order to sort of work through the really hard things that we face in cities every day. And I was thinking it would have been great to have the mayor of Halifax speak before this panel, because he said hit so many points right on that I'm going to build on. So urban citizenship in this panel is a lot about participation, and in cities it's a lot about cooperation, but it's also a lot about conflict. And we all think that engagement is a good idea. You must become engaged, you must participate, you must consult people, and everybody says sure. But too much of the time, the activity that's happening here in terms of engagement and consultation is quite independent from the decision-making at the highest levels of power. And the intent of our work is trying to demonstrate what steps governments can take to more closely connect the two. If we don't do that, of course, there are consequences. People lose trust in government. We breed cynicism. I came and talked to you and nothing happened. If we're going to ask people what they think, we have to tell them what we did with what they said. And that means you don't have to do everything they said. Of course not. But you have to close the loop. You have to say, these are the decisions that are open for influence. This is what we heard from you, and this is how it's integrated into what we're going to be doing. So I'm going to make a few observations about the situation a little bit, how we see it, and then what to do about it. So if you're in a city, and you're living in a city, there's a few things you're facing that you've never faced before. You're living in 400 square feet. And that park all of a sudden became way more important to you, as did to the thousands of people that live right next door to you. So how are you going to use that park? Do you want to walk your dog off leash? That's the hardest meeting I've ever run in my entire life. People who have dogs. Anyway, it's tough. I mean, it's the only harder thing right now is the Island Airport in Toronto, and I'm happy to talk about that when we get to the panel if you want. But it's tough. You know, we're having really, there's real conflicts over what do you value and where are you going to direct resources. And, you know, Yonge and Eglinton, there's going to get tens of thousands of new people in the next very immediate amount of time, in 20 years, 10 years, 15 years, and there's one great park. And so, you know, we're hashing it out over, do I get to sit and read my book calmly? Do I get to walk through? Does your bike get to go through here full speed? Or do the little kids that have no other place to play have an organized soccer league taking over 100% of the park? I mean, it's going to be a tough conversation. We're also living longer, and we're not driving. Not only driving, because we're not, maybe you're over 80, maybe you're over 90 and you need to get around, so you need transit, but also lots of kids, I like to consider myself a kid. Lots of young people are moving downtown Toronto, and I'm doing a bit of a Toronto-centric perspective here, but I'll try and branch it out. A lot of people are moving downtown without a car, and the pressures on transit are huge. And decisions around transit are very hard to get your head around. All the factors that have to be considered when you decide, do you want a bus, do you want an LRT, or do you want a subway? And we have not done ourselves any favors with the amount of information and the type of information that is coming out around transit decisions, particularly in Toronto, because it's a dog's breakfast. It would be very hard for the most educated to try and navigate through this system, and some of us are working very hard to change that. And the third thing from a citizen's point of view, just an observation, is there's more and more discussion around the tensions between private and public. So we have a lot of privately owned public spaces. So let's talk about who and how we get to access them. But this is where some of the work that Sharon mentioned, that we're working for the province of Ontario, talking to people about what they think about TransCanada's Energy East pipeline. And there's conversations over and over again about the privatization of gain and the socialization of risk. This is tough. How do we talk about that? How do we make decisions and sort it through? So that's what's from a citizen's perspective. From a government perspective, how do we pay for growth? Does growth pay for itself? We did a lot of work in Regina, where every developer has to pay to connect to the sewer system, but those cumulative connections don't then add up to the price of improving the main trunk sewer, And who's going to pay for that? So how are we paying for growth? There's higher expectations on transparency and accountability. And just because it meets the regulatory requirements does not mean you have the social license to do it. So we have to think a little bit more creatively. So what to do about it? And I've got about a minute and a half. Yeah, a minute, good. Trust that people have the capacity. And I don't think any of this should be surprising, but hopefully it's useful coming from another lens. Trust that people have the capacity to learn things and change their mind. You often come with a fixed opinion into a particular conversation, and when you're open to learning about how another person sees it or the consequences on them, then you thought, well, I never thought of that. Maybe I'm going to think about this a little bit differently. There are deliberate steps we can take to that governments can take to help people see things from multiple perspectives. We often start meetings by saying, look, whose job is it to find common ground among dozen, 100, 1,000, millions of people? Governments are in a very, very strong position to be able to help create frameworks for people to have conversations. I would be happy not to exist as an organization. If I travel in Europe, people say, isn't that government's job? And in many ways it is, but we have to relearn under these new and changing conditions, how to do meaningful engagement between elections. We also have to remind people that there's a lot of public benefits, but along with public benefits come public responsibilities. Yes, the value of your house goes up if you have a park next door and a community center and a library, but don't put that group home or that affordable housing there. Okay, so now let's talk about it. What is it about the public investments that you want to benefit from? And what responsibility do we collectively have to figure out how to live together? And these are also hard conversations. So let's push people a little bit and trust that they have the capacity to learn things and change their mind. Also, trust that people can and will put aside their individual self-interest to achieve collective goals. They will do this when they support decisions that they believe... It's the timer. Okay, I got it. A community will support a decision that it considers to be the results of its own deliberation. And even when you have extreme conflict, if they're given a space where they believe that in a fair way, the logic behind their rationale can be aired and other people are meaningfully listening, they can find a way to work together. And finally, just to wrap up, of course, this all comes back to, in my view, we spend 90%, we do community engagement, and everybody says, well, make sure you get these kinds of people in the room and these kinds of people. We spent the vast majority of our time with our clients, the governments and the nonprofits, and some of them are fantastic and some of them are tough. Where are you open to influence? Reveal yourself. It's not everywhere, and it's not every decision. So say, these are the open doors to the discussion, these are the closed doors, and ask people, and you will be delighted. Because yesterday, somebody said you couldn't be delighted by cities anymore. I think you will be delighted what you hear. Anyway, that's it for me. Happy to answer questions during the panel.
Hi. I'm Denise Balcassoon. I'm a journalist. I was really excited to hear what Jane and Nicole had to say, because what I have to say really builds on that. So I am from Toronto, and my sense of being an urban citizen is very much about growing up in Toronto. When I was 11, my dad ran for city council, and he was on city council for 17 years. And so very much when I was little, like, my experience of being a child is going door to door and going to community meetings, and like municipal politics is very much a part of my life. So I always had a sense of responsibility, that it was my responsibility to learn about what was going on, that it was my responsibility to participate, that it was my responsibility to convince other people, you know, that my idea was right. But at the same time, what I didn't have for a very long time and that I still wrestle with is a sense of belonging to Toronto, that the city and the people who had power understood my experience and where I was coming from. And that may sound strange because my dad was a politician, he was elected, but there's actually a story or a column by Royce and James in the Toronto Star yesterday. And so he put the numbers right there for me. And in 180 years, there have been 14 city councillors in Toronto who were not white. So, you know, it was very much this push and pull that I was born there, I grew up there, I was sort of tapped in, like I knew what was going on, but I grew up in the suburbs, and my experiences were not reflected in the gentrifying downtown, you know, place of power. And so when I started working, I became a journalist, and part of that is because I care very much about the public conversation. And again, it was like, you know, all of my colleagues, the ones that I like the most, the ones that I respect the most, they still didn't really get it. Like they didn't, I would propose stories and I would propose news stories and features and arts, and like, it just did not compute as to who that would be interesting to and who would read it and who might actually pay to read it. And so 4 years ago in the summer of 2011, I got together with a number of other writers and journalists in Toronto, and we started a blog. It's called The Ethnic Isle. It's at theethnicisle.com. And the point is just to take the supposed diversity and multiculturalism of the Greater Toronto Area, which is not just the city of Toronto, but all of the suburbs around it, and actually talk about that, not just in serious ways, not just in ways about policy or, you know, politics, but in every sort of way about families and arts and funny things and silly things, but just talk, have the people that are driving that conversation actually be from those places and actually have those experiences and have it be meaningful. Because I think what the other panelists have spoken about and what is so much my experience is that a lot of this stuff is like so top down and someone's like, well, we studied this, so let me tell you how it's going to work. And even if that is something I agree with, it doesn't always translate, or sometimes it comes across as really condescending. And so I wanted to talk about two things that really define Toronto right now, one of which is extremely depressing and one of which is extremely successful. And so the one that is not working at all is transit, and the one that really is working is Drake, the musician. I'm very serious about this. And so when you talk about transit, you know, the story is just so, like, it is an absolute downer. In the 90s, the government spent $90 million to dig a hole for a new subway and then fill it back in. And the mayor, two mayors ago, David Miller, he proposed a light right rapid transit network that would actually go into the suburbs where people have the worst access to transit and actually link it to downtown, and it would be fast and it would be built in a reasonable amount of time on a reasonable budget. But nobody went for it. Like, nobody who actually would take those lines got behind it and got excited about it and talked about it to each other. And there are very many reasons that happened. But one of them, in my point of view, is that it was this very top-down approach. Like, we study this, and this is the cheapest way, and this is the fastest way, and this is what's going to happen. And meanwhile, a lot of politicians came in and really exploited some of the divisions and made it into this story that the rich and white downtown had subways and that the outer and non-white suburbs were going to get rapid transit, and it all blew up, and now we don't know what's happening, and there are a million proposals on the table, and we're just wasting money on contracts. And meanwhile, I live 10 kilometers from the Globe and Mail, which is where I'm working right now, and it can sometimes take me 45 minutes to get to work, and it's just, I can't, you know, from where my parents live in North Scarborough, it can take an hour and a half if you don't get short-turned, and you're definitely not going to get a seat. It's just awful. Drake, on the other hand, is extremely successful, but he's not only personally successful. He really has convinced me that he loves Toronto, and one of the ways that he's convinced me is that in his songs, he's not just talking about the CN Tower, and he's not just talking about downtown. He talks about expensive restaurants, but he talks about Scarborough. He talks about the intersection where I went to high school, and he talks about what people do, and in his videos he shows actual real Torontonians and the support that he has got from the city. I mean, he's not only one of the most famous rappers in the world right now, but he is definitely the most famous celebrity in Toronto. He signed on to represent the Raptors, and going to Drake Night at the Raptors is like just a crazy scene. Like, everyone is so happy to be there.
And in my opinion, part of why is because he met people where they actually are. And one example of that is he has a big music festival the first weekend of August, OVO Fest, and it's impossible to get tickets for. I tried. And so here's the thing, right? So he has this hip-hop and rap music festival, and he wants to have it in the summer. And what weekend does he pick? He picks the weekend that West Indian people are already in Toronto because it's Caribana. It's Caribbean Festival. And Caribana is so hilarious because it brings so much money and so much excitement and so many tourists into Toronto, and nobody, like in the media where I work and in government, other than, you know, the mayor goes and dances with some girls in sexy outfits, but like the idea that it is a huge, huge attraction in Toronto is just not even there at all. But because, you know, Drake is from that community, because he's a musician, he said, if we have a rap festival the same weekend as Caribana, it's going to be massive. And it is massive. And it's made Toronto, like, the place to party in North America in the first weekend of August. And in my opinion, it is because he already tapped into a sense of belonging to expand that and make people excited about the city. So when I think about urban citizenship, I think about responsibility, but I also think about belonging. And if we want people to participate, you know, it's not just about telling other people what to do based on your ideas. It's figuring out how to sell your ideas and give them, make other people feel like they belong to them as well. Thanks very much.
Good morning, and thank you for putting on what has been quite an amazing, amazing conference. I'm from Ottawa, and I'm here to help you. I'm going to be speaking on urban citizenship, and I thought that perhaps we should start by finding out the definition for citizen. I have a 16-year-old daughter and a 34-year-old son, and I'm continually being accused of not being hip. And so I didn't go to the Webster's Dictionary, I went to the Urban Dictionary. And the citizen, a citizen is described as this: a type of man's haircut that is done to make the person look like an upstanding member of the community. The haircut is short, above the ears, and off the collar. An example is the customer: hey, give me a citizen, I got a court date. Barber: will do, we'll get you off. Citizenship, from my point of view, carries responsibility and also demands that you participate in engagement. And we're looking at urban rather than suburban. I find it interesting that you're from Scarborough, but you want to say you're from Toronto. I don't see it as that. I see it, I'm from Scarborough. And one of the difficulties we have with citizenship and municipalities is this continual idea that we need to cram everybody together and make them Toronto, or make them Montreal, or make them Ottawa. And I would suggest to you that every time we do that, we lessen the ability for a person to feel like a citizen of a community, rather than try to cram them into this political idea that it's more efficient, it's more cost-effective, it works better. I would defy you again to tell me that Montreal, when it was amalgamated, worked well. I would defy you to tell me that Toronto, under Mayor Ford, worked well, or that Ottawa works well. It simply doesn't happen because you lose that sense of who you are. I'm from Vancouver. I'm not from Surrey. I'm not from Burnaby. I'm from Vancouver. And perhaps more important, not only am I from Vancouver, but I'm from Point Grey, which drives my citizenship even further down on the scale. Part of citizen engagement is that you have to lower the barriers for people to engage. It's interesting, and I'm embarrassed every time I see the results of an election. I'm embarrassed, but you know, I used to say, if you don't vote, don't complain, but then I realized that not voting actually is making a social statement. It actually is saying something about your citizenship. And the problem with this is of course, that politicians only care about getting their vote out. You hear that all the time. Their vote. And so we end up with a federal government that's been elected by a minority of Canadians, okay, in very specialized sort of cliquish little places. And we end up with a government that's running Canada that, quite frankly, I don't even recognize it anymore. And this is the problem. They don't care about engaging. They don't want to engage it. They start with 30%, and all they got to find is 10% someplace. And so it's all about wedge issues. And those wedge issues directly affect me as a citizen and affect my ability to engage at all levels. I would say to you that the most important political arena is the municipal. Not the provincial, not the feds. They don't give you anything. They take it and they spend it, but they don't build anything. At the municipal level, we're continually building. We're continually challenging. We're continually looking at how we get people out. When I ran for mayor, we went down to the downtown east side, the poorest postal code in Canada, and one of the worst places to see a vote go on, and we engaged that community. We went to every single building. We talked to these people, huge Aboriginal, older people, poverty, abuse. They were abandoned, and we said to them, come on, you got to vote. And they were like, why? And we had to explain to them why, that if you don't vote, we'll never hear from you. And we got 5,000 people come out of that community to vote. There were no barriers. We'd send buses for them. We'd pick them up. We'd walk them. And that's what you have to do. But once you have them engaged, it's the responsibility of the citizen to stay engaged, to not just challenge, not just tear down, but build up. Look at things we can do. And again, we heard that here, where you go out into the community and you say, what would you like this to look like? And they put together ideas. And you decide which ones we can do and which ones we can't do. We've probably lost one, and I would suspect two generations of people who could care less what an old bugger like me says. And why is that? Because we don't engage them. You know, I mean, I come from the days when, you know, there was that little X button on your Selectric typewriter and you thought, my God, can anything get more forward thinking than this? Seriously, I stole those typewriters when I was a coroner. They got sent to my office by mistake. I said, pack up the old ones, send them to headquarters and don't tell anybody. But that's where we find ourselves. We're moving so quickly. We're moving so fast that I can't keep up, nor should I. But I have to have those two generations engaged to make it move forward. If we don't do this, if we don't engage our citizens, if we do not get these two generations engaged, we will fulfill the prophecy of Prime Minister Harper, who said, you won't recognize this country. Thank you.
Well, I hope you got a few ideas from that. We're going to, as the practice is here, engage in a discussion within the panel for the first half hour or so, and then open the floor to the audience for the last 15 minutes or so. We encourage everybody, including students, to ask questions, and utiliser la langue officielle de votre choix. Let's get going. We talked a little bit among ourselves beforehand to see what we would like to explore, not having heard each other's presentations. And some of the questions that came to mind, and I guess the most fundamental one is, what is urban citizenship? We've heard different variations here. The question I always ask myself when I hear a new term is, what makes it different from other terms? Like, why is it different from national citizenship or global citizenship, or for that matter, suburban or rural citizenship? And are people identifying more with their cities than with their province or their country now? So I'd like to open up this question with Jane. And then anybody can jump in after that.
Yeah, so I think that even as we heard from the four of us, but also other talks during this conference and elsewhere, the things that we read, that we all encounter every day, our notions of citizenship are changing rapidly. And I think it's an incredibly interesting time. You know, I like to think about Benjamin Barber when I think about notions of citizenship. He provocatively says how nation states are abstractions, right? Cities are what matter. Cities are where people are at home. Cities are what are very meaningful to us. So whether it's cities, communities, whatever it is. But I guess, and I'm also drawing some inspiration from what Denise said about the sense of belonging. Because I was thinking about citizenship in terms of responsibilities and rights, and also boundaries and limitations. So there are geographic boundaries when we think about citizenship, but also access limitations. But the sense of belonging, I think, is so important, too. And for urban citizenship in particular, to me, the rights that come to mind in talking about is the collective right or right to the city, as we talked about some yesterday, but also a right to human flourishing, which is more at an individual level. And for responsibility, to me it comes down to something that, you know, rather than just urban citizenship, I guess I think about it as active urban citizenship, or sometimes we've heard this called insurgent citizenship or participatory citizenship or inclusive citizenship. And to me, this is something that's emerging as people's desires and hunger for change are changing the way they engage in cities. And I think this has a huge impact on urban citizenship. So people want to create on their own terms and innovate on their own terms how they engage in cities. So we're seeing that through events and festivals like 101 Day and so on. But I can say, and I'll close this response by saying, you know, I've practiced participatory urban planning for many years. So I have a whole large toolbox of tools to engage people in public processes and so on. And increasingly I'm finding and I'm questioning all of those tools and thinking, I just have to open things up, let people create. People want to make cities on their own terms. So how can we better do that? That's urban citizenship for me.
Anyone else like to jump in?
I think that one of the things that we have to do as politicians is that we have to empower people. We have to allow them to know that what they say is important. And I'll give you an example. When we were going for the supervised injection site, I was the chief coroner. There was 200 people dying a year in Vancouver, and I went to an unsupervised injection site where addicts were shooting up, and they said to me they don't know what to do, that nobody will listen to them. And my answer to them was, go raise a little hell. And that's what they did. They took over the street. They took over the art gallery. They raised hell. And people started realizing that these were people, that they were mothers and fathers. And that may be an extreme example, but you have to empower the people to be able to go out and make decisions and make contributions. And people, lots of people are reticent to do that. They're, you know, we're not Che Guevara. And so you have to tell them that sometimes you just have to grab it and you have to run with it. And I think that, you know, I'd never heard, what was the term that you used? Insurgent. I love that. I'm going to use that one. I like that one. And that's what you have to do. And you've got to get them involved. You got to let them know that, and you can't ever let them down. Once you let them in, they aren't going to leave. So you want to be able to, you know, keep that thing going.
Anyone else like to jump in?
I'll send you the article.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another set of questions that we were pondering over a teleconference.
What are some of the success factors in creating good urban citizens, and what are some of the difficulties preventing it? Nicole?
So I think that every big difficult project we've ever worked on is only because somebody was raising a little hell in every case. It was good urban citizens' success factor for good urban citizenship is caring about what's happening around you and doing something that feels like maybe nobody's going to like it, but you better do it anyway. Because if you don't demonstrate that you care, I mean, nobody else is going to care for you. I think it's, but obviously from my remarks at the podium, I think it's really very much a two-way street. I also see, of course, my confidence will always go to citizens because they're going to be there all the time, and secondarily to governments, which is just fine with me, I think. We should be encouraging people to organize and to speak up and advocate for what they want, but at the same time, governments have a huge responsibility and a big success factor, I think, from the very creative and innovative people we've had the good fortune of working with, is to open up and demonstrate where you really need help. Where do you really need, just like Larry went out into the streets, you know, come, we need you. We need to understand from your perspective. And if you don't tell us, we're going to decide for you. And the thing is that for good citizenship to work, you have to recognize that people actually understand the conditions of their lives. They don't have to be told. And this is an arrogance, I think, that Denise was describing a little bit. I mean, you don't have to tell somebody that, I know your life sucks, or I know that it's really tough for you, or I know where you might want to live in the future, or I know it'll be better for you to move from the neighborhood you're in to another neighborhood. Your life will be better. That's not your decision to make on their behalf, and we do that a lot. We need to trust that good citizenship includes trusting what citizens bring.
What are some of the barriers that you see in your work, though, for people getting involved in the kind of things?
People are terrified to talk to the public.
That's true.
Of course it's true.
I don't even know how to describe, watching people in politics. I mean, they would rather shoot themselves and go into a room full of people where they're going to ask questions, where they might have to say, hell, I don't know.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the biggest worry of a hell, I don't know. I mean, it's like you're spawned as a politician and you come out fully formed with all of the knowledge in the world. Instead of going into that room, not expecting to be asked questions that you can't answer, but expecting to be asked questions that you should pursue yourself and within that room to include, be inclusive, to throw everybody into it. The barriers, lots of times, I'm from Vancouver, and I quite frankly think Vancouver is way more diverse than Toronto, sorry. And Vancouver has seized itself with this diversity. It's hard to describe. It's not like if you're Indo-Canadian, you're not from Vancouver. If you're Indo-Canadian, you're like, right on, we're going to Vaisakhi Day. To the Chinese community, the Filipino community. And when it comes to the political part of it, depending where you come from, gives you some idea of where you want to go. For instance, I know that certain communities think that municipal politics are down here, and they want to go provincial and federal, and so we see that. Mm-hmm. And yet others come from countries where, like, the city is the place, and so they get involved in that. So you have to recognize that even within the cities, there is diversity among the ethnic groups. Thank you.
And thanks for picking it up, because I mean, the challenge was, people are scared because they think that they're in a position where they're expected to know better, or this is actually the antithesis of your responsibility. You're not supposed to know better. And so just because this Bosnian experience was quite formative for me, because we were talking to, it was early 2000s, it was just after the war, and Canada was funding a government accountability and transparency project. We thought how we would do that, we would do public consultation on the first
land use plan for the cantonal level of government. So there was municipal and countrywide. And so in the office of a transportation engineer, and we suggested, why don't you go consult on the issues that people might be facing living in the canton? For example, transportation. I am the only one that knows about transportation engineering. I will tell you what the situation is. So, but what about the person that lives in X and Y Street? Don't you think they might know something about what happens at the corner of X and Y Street? This was a completely new notion that the people that were actually living there would have content to contribute that might be different. Of course, this was one example, but I use it because how many times do you go to a public meeting when somebody stands at the front of the room and people ask questions or say, I'd really like to see that, and somebody at the front says, well, I knew that already. I knew you were going to say that, and I've already solved your problem. There's a humility that has to come along with public service that recognizes that you are there to listen and demonstrate how what people are saying is translated into your actions, regardless of whether you knew that already.
So the barriers are on both sides, you're saying. Yeah. Well, Larry talked a little bit about disengagement, and so did Denise, and I just wanted to turn to that question about disengagement from urban citizenship. What should cities be doing to make it easier for people to get engaged?
Is this working?
Yes. I think so.
Okay. The list is so extensive. What could you do? You could have voting on the weekend so that people don't have to figure out the hour in between getting to work and picking up their kids and feeding their kids. I think it's really about going to people where they are, but not in a lip service-y sort of way. Like, you show up at whatever cultural festival they have once a year and, you know, eat whatever food they have. But in a regular way, participate. Because, the whole idea of disengagement is maybe a little bit insulting or condescending, because people are participating in their communities every single day. And so it's like, how do you make those two things relevant or meet each other, which is what Nicole is speaking to. If you're saying who is not participating in capital P politics, people who are poor and renters and young people. And I think all the barriers are pretty obvious, right? And so why are people disengaged? Because they're busy, because they have other things to do, because they think other things are more important. And maybe those things actually do build the city in good ways. And so we should appreciate that and sort of incorporate that if being part of capital P politics or capital P public life is what we'd like to see.
Ms. Jane? I think another element of it is that cities are huge projects, right? They're hugely complex. It's the largest thing that human beings create. And they also change very slowly in some ways. We can change ephemeral space on a regular basis, but our institutions and our infrastructure in cities change so slowly. And so I think that people grow to expect that the dominant paradigm will just continue to reproduce itself, right? And so they don't expect more. They don't necessarily expect for change. They expect that if road work is going to be done, that the street will be rebuilt exactly the same way it was before, and not question that it could be done completely differently. So I think there's also that too, and to me that's not a question of people not wanting to engage. It's more a function of the temporal aspect of urban form. Once it's set, once we have this dominant paradigm of the second half of the 20th century, how we built cities, we just expect that to be reproduced. And people are recognizing now that we can intervene, we can change that, but changing institutions and infrastructure is no easy project.
I think one of the major barriers, and we heard it yesterday, is communicating back and forth. And we heard from the head of digital for Vancouver. To her, it was significant that there were 9 clicks to register for a yoga class.
19.
That would never have entered my mind, because I'm not of the digital age. But when she expressed that, you realized how important that is, and how important that is for those generations that I'm worried about us missing. And so the communications, and we always talk about communications. I mean, government talks about communications daily. But I don't know that we actually practice it. I don't know that, and I was proud to see that that was coming in Vancouver, and it really made me think about, you know, how little I really know about this, the digital age, but how important it is for us to have people involved in that to move forward.
Yeah, well, I guess yesterday we heard people saying that the Constitution of Canada was written before electricity was invented. And I guess we have to, those of us who study governments know that the bureaucratic system as it exists today was conceived in the 19th century. Now we're talking about both of those things needing to evolve. And one of the things might be interesting to discuss is why urban citizenship is emerging now, just as all of these issues are coming to a head. Why is it becoming more important for policy and decision makers at this moment in time? And is there something that other levels of government and other bureaucracies can learn from cities about citizenship? Larry, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I think the one reason that we're seeing it rise to the surface is that we're out of money. Cities are a child of the province, an orphan, as far as I'm concerned. And things have been downloaded so far, so fast, onto just property taxes that citizens in the city are starting to revolt. And it's interesting that in Vancouver, where transit is huge, and we're having a vote on whether we should have a 0.05 tax in the lower mainland to fund it. Of course we should, and yet out of the midst of time comes the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, which is interesting because the majority of people who are using transit don't have to pay any taxes because they don't make enough money to be able to pay federal taxes. And so there's this ongoing discourse, but I think the cities are rising up because they're saying, you know, it's going to implode. You know, when you start having chunks falling off your bridges, you got a problem. You got a big problem. And when your sewage system starts going, you got a problem. And it's not going to take place overnight. And we just, the cities don't have the money. The province isn't going to cough it up. And the feds sure aren't coughing it up. And so I think that's why we see this. It's almost like a rise of city states. I mean, we have the big city mayors conference. We're the ones that had Prime Minister Martin give us back the gas tax, the PST. I mean, that was the first time the federal government had ever given anything to us. And the provinces weren't happy about that. Mm-hmm. They weren't happy at all that we were going to get this money without it going through their hands so they could take their little chunk off the top.
Yeah.
And so that's why there's a revolution going on. Okay. That's why we see more people moving into the cities, but we can't handle any more people moving into the cities.
Jane, you had something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I wanted to add to that as well. And we heard it yesterday from the mayors in the room, right? And we hear that over and over from mayors, right? They're tired of going hat in hand to their provincial governments, not only for money, but for decisions, you know, just not having the kinds of powers or radical decentralization that Adam talked about this morning. And it's interesting because as part of Cities for People, we've engaged a lot with people with leaders within municipalities. And what they tell us is that, you know, we can't do this alone. We've been trying through big city mayors. We've been trying through lots of networks of municipal either elected officials or staff. And they can't make the change. They actually need citizens to demand it and citizens to want it, which is one of the reasons that our curator Evergreen City Works initiated We Are Cities, the campaign that I was talking about, because that's an invitation for people, for anyone to engage and say, this is how we see cities in Canada evolving. This is our vision. This is how we think we can get there. And so we're opening that conversation up to anybody who wants to participate, and we're hoping
that that will be, that kind of invitation will lead to change that that municipalities on their own have not been able to achieve.
So, Nicole and Denise, do you think the power of citizens will be able to move us forward into a new deal for cities?
I think it could. I think it could if people get excited enough. I sort of feel that we're not really in an era of street action right now, but maybe that's just based on me. Yeah, well, maybe, exactly. Or just like me growing older, like I don't march in the streets as much as I used to. I'm sort of maybe on the previous question, which is who's disengaged or what are the barriers? And back to the last Toronto election, I was really excited about some of the candidates from all over the city who actually were from different ethnicities and they actually lived in their communities. And when the results came in, only one incumbent was unseated, and that was a really big downer for me. So I would say another barrier, and this is possibly a terrible thing to say for the daughter of a politician, but I also really believe in term limits, and so that people really feel they don't have to run against incumbents who always have such a great advantage, and that we can hear some new voices and people really feel like they can win. And I believe the previous presenter showed some numbers that might have supported that. I'm not sure because my French isn't great, but it looks like that elections that didn't have incumbents got greater participation. And so I think it's also, as Jane was saying, like people tend to think that situations are fossilized and that they can't make a difference anyway. Whereas if they had a chance to choose someone new, they might come out and they might actually get excited.
And I'm just going to quickly, because yeah, I want to yeah, get to the yeah, yeah, the questions. Yeah. Okay, go to questions.
Okay. Well, the floor is now open for questions, and may I invite you to state who you are, and if you have a particular person you want to answer first, let us know.
Sure. Good morning. My name is Oscar Espinosa. I actually work for Radio Canada, but I'm in the process of transitioning my career towards something that has to do with sustainable urbanism. The question is not for one person specifically. It's more for the panel as a whole. And there's comments and questions. So first, I think there's between the last one and this panel, I think there are good examples worldwide of when it comes to participative urbanism, as well as participation between the private and the public sector. I don't know if you guys are familiarized with the North Haven project in Copenhagen. It's like the water city front project. And it really is like a true example of both participative urbanism, but as well as the different aspects that can be considered for major urban projects. Also because they didn't focus on certain certifications like we do here, like LEED. They have other certifications that encompass more the social and the social cultural aspect of conceptualizing urban projects. So if you don't, I invite you to take a look at the project. And my question relates to also this idea of disengagement and how to engage, how to involve people. Personally, I think that interns, both at the government as well as organizations level, interns or universities are an amazing source of free resources and people who have that drive and that desire to get involved. And we've lost a couple of generations that don't have that drive anymore, but these are the people who will eventually get into those positions that can make decisions and that can have an impact. So I don't know if you guys are at all present in universities, in school forums and stuff like that, but I think that is like a real treasure to be discovered and to get people involved in projects, as well as someone mentioned in the last panel, diversity, people from all social spectrums, not just the people who can afford to live in certain areas or who come from a certain background. So that's it.
Okay. Do you want to start, Jane?
Yeah, I totally appreciate the commentary, and
take that on board. We have, you know, in this very modest experimental phase of Cities for People, we have a small intern program, but we could actually be doing much more. And I hope, you know, as we look ahead to the future, that we'll do a whole lot more, because you're absolutely right. You know, there's just a huge amount of individual and collective energy there to draw on much more. And you know, it's issues around inclusion in the same way. You know, if we're not deliberately fighting social exclusion in everything we do, then we're not going to grow in the ways that we need to. So thanks for that.
I try to bring interns in every summer to give mainly their poli-sci, to give them some experience on the Hill, some idea of what goes on there. I want to make a comment, though. I didn't mean that the generation, maybe two generations, they're not lost. And they're certainly not sitting there not doing anything. They're running parallel, faster, and moving forward ahead of the politicians. That's the critical thing. If we had them involved, we'd all be moving at warp speed. But because we've ignored them or we haven't engaged them, they're moving forward. They're not standing still. I'm not saying we've got two generations sitting out there doing nothing. They're very much engaged in that. But we need to bring them in and help us.
I think Denise wanted to get in here too.
Well, I'm not sure if I can support unpaid internships, I think.
I pay my interns.
Exactly.
That's all I really wanted to say.
There's no future for unpaid internships. It's not fair.
Next question, please.
Hi. My name is Enbal. I'm a recent graduate, so hence I also don't agree with unpaid internships. And I was wondering, it's sort of a two-part question related to immigrants to cities. I kind of assume we are kind of thinking about them when we're thinking about citizens of cities. And the first part is, if you have come upon or have any sort of creative solutions for dealing with the fact that many people cannot vote in municipal elections, and increasingly so, they perhaps cannot participate in non-voting forms of participation due to increasing precarity of legal status for people. So perhaps you have legal status now, but with certain changes to immigration laws, it's becoming riskier. People can't post things online as much anymore, and citizenship can apparently be revoked. So with that increasing concern, how to engage people who cannot participate so much in politics. And then the second part, sorry, it's kind of a lot, is how to deal with certain biases which come from the fact that not everybody can vote, and that it perhaps is a bigger issue in the situation of municipalities than perhaps the provincial and federal government, because immigrants kind of gravitate towards cities.
I can start on the first part. There's a lot of communities where having me walk in is not going to help anybody want to talk to me. I may not speak their language. I don't look like them. I don't come from a background that they do. So what we've done a lot is worked with networks of people. So we worked with the province on the review on the roots of youth violence. I have no credibility walking into the back door of Jane and Finch or any of the tough neighborhoods in tough and amazing neighborhoods, not just tough, amazing neighborhoods, but we find young people who are leaders in those communities, and those leaders are known to people at the community center, people in schools, and we create teams of people who are interested in then going into the community. So there's many layers. You can still get people involved in a meaningful conversation and make sure that feedback comes back to the policymakers. You just have to go through people that have existing networks and are already trusted and are able to connect and speak the language and already know the issues. So that should be obvious, but that's the first part.
Yeah, I appreciate the question too, and I think there are lots of good precedents for voting in local elections without having citizenship. I lived in the UK for a while, and I had temporary resident status, and I was eligible to vote in municipal elections. Mike Savage, mayor of Halifax, yesterday argued that that is, he's trying to change the law so that permanent residents can vote. I'm particularly sensitive to this. I'm an immigrant to Canada, and I couldn't vote for a very long time, after being here. I think it's a big issue, and we could certainly do something about it.
Okay, next question, please.
Hi, my name is Kristen Perry. I'm an environmental science student at McGill University. I'm also part of Divest McGill, which is asking the local to take its investments out of fossil fuels. And so I'm going to keep my question pretty brief. Nicole was talking a lot about kind of Energy East and how that pipeline is following a trend of privatization of the profit and then socialization of risks. And I think like the fossil fuel industry and climate change is a really great example of that. So my question is, I'm wondering if you have any ideas on how to really be involved in this process as citizens, especially since the regulatory body, the NEB, has a really narrow definition of directly impacted citizens are only allowed to intervene in the process, and they're not really considering climate impacts, which is kind of ridiculous because there's 7 billion cars equivalent of building this pipeline. And so I'm wondering how we can get more involved in the process, especially when we're not having the issues that are necessarily important to us being included in the existing systems.
I have two suggestions. I think one of the reasons I'm here today is because of our work on that. And the last time I think the NEB had a hearing on a pipeline, Ontario came in late in the game and didn't have a great experience. So this time for Energy East, the minister was really proactive and asked the Ontario Energy Board to go across the province and talk to Ontarians. We did a two-part process. Just to throw in, you can never gain any credibility by talking to somebody once. You always got to come back and show that you did what you said you were going to do. So anytime you see a one-off public meeting, your antenna should go up. So what happened was we hit the road and everybody said the NEB doesn't consider climate change, but we don't care. Ontario, you should consider climate change. Community after community after community. And to the OEB's credit, backed by the province of Ontario, they hired a consultant to look into climate change and their final report will include climate change. So while we heard from many that were frustrated at being excluded from the national level, there are things that the province was doing, and that fed down to municipalities. There were organizations of people in North Bay who are concerned about the contamination of Trout Lake, their major source of drinking water. Because the province held the community meeting, we heard that people who otherwise would never have normally been in the same room were in the same room, and we went back the second time, and now they had organizations formed. So just because you're excluded from the NEB doesn't mean there aren't ways that you can engage at the local and provincial level. That would be my message.
Thank you so much. Those are great insights.
Okay. Hi, Will Straw. I guess my question is mostly for Denise. I'm looking at the title of the conference. What are the media that cities need if we want to change citizenship? I mean, and how far are we from having it?
That's very interesting because right now, whenever anyone in the media gets together, everyone gets really depressed about how there's no money and no one's paying to read the media, and of course the internet has a lot to do with that, but I really think it also has to do a lot with, like, you're not speaking to people, so why should they pay $1.50 for this paper? And so the media that we need is one that people want to read because they feel like it's relevant to them and because they feel like, again, not just the serious issues, but all of the things that make up their lives are reflected in that. And again, it's not just like covering the fireworks at Diwali. It's like what is happening every single day in all these different places. It's very hard to fund. I don't think anyone knows what the funding model is. It might end up being crowdfunded or crowdsourced. We're going to be doing a crowdfunding at the Ethnic Isle this spring, if anyone would like to check it out. A non
ethnic example is Canada Land, the podcast, which some of you may know about. And Jesse Brown is a colleague and a friend of mine, and he is doing amazingly well. And it's because people are like, we really want this. We really, really want this. And so we'll give small amounts of money that turn into a big amount of money. So I guess what I would say is we need media that, where the people in charge might think for a second that even though they don't get that story, that someone else might get it and someone else might read it and sort of have a way of making, you know, taking risks and seeing if they pay off. And then as the people that consume media, if you could support the media that you like and believe in, that would also be great.
No other responses on media? Okay.
All right.
Next questioner, please.
Hi there. I'm Andrew Pollack. I'm a recent graduate of McGill. And I tweeted this question, but I wanted to bring it to the panel as well. It's in response to the comment that was the really good comment, people are terrified to talk to the public, because I'm one of those people. But anyway, it made me think of sort of consultative processes where it's maybe a town hall setting, and the discussion becomes dominated by vocal positional camps that tend to be kind of aggressive. And for me, being a bit of an introvert, it becomes tough to, you know, put yourself out there. So I guess the question becomes, how do we foster safe space in public consultation and citizenship? And how do we prevent that consultation from becoming something more like Spartan democracy, where the people who yell loudest get the decision made?
Nicole.
Thank you.
So this is extremely tough. One of the reasons public meetings are really important is because, and I've been taught this from the people in the communities, is so that anybody can stand up and address the entire room. This is a really important function. This is why a public meeting with display boards that knock people off one by one, or a small table discussion or breakout sessions only, are not acceptable, because one of the reasons public meetings are important is so you can address everybody. That being said, there is a real, you really need to make the case and be convincing that there is value to having a smaller discussion along with a big discussion. So straight to the mechanics of running a meeting, we have been well received in communities where you don't have a setup like this, us and them. We don't have a head table. We don't even have fancy name tags. People are sitting at round tables, so you have a chance to speak to each other before you have to line up at a mic and you get there and you're shaking and you just exploded and that's the end of it, right? That's not a good two-way dialogue. So round table discussion over theater-style seating, which is way better than display boards. What we tried to do, and I have to tell you, we are, so two questions. One, I'm going to leave you all with one, and then you can try and figure it out and tell me. We're really wrestling with clapping. Really, really hard question. Some people are nervous, and when someone else says something that they like, they want to clap. And then what happens? We are at the beginning of the end of the safe space for you to speak up if you do not have that same opinion. So we got people in Toronto, when we started this conversation for the Toronto Port Authority, now Ports Toronto, they came to us and said, I don't feel safe because if I tell anybody that I like the idea of that airport getting bigger, I got a target on my back. If I come to a meeting and I'm against it, somebody's going to co-opt my participation and make it look like I agreed. I should be at home working right now on this project. It is so hard. But before we started it, we talked to some people, and they said, do you think it's possible for Toronto to have a meaningful conversation about the future of this airport? And they said, yes. So you better believe we're going to have public meetings. You can go to the website and see how we're doing it. But every time we go, it's hard. It's hard for the Port Authority. They don't feel safe. It's hard for the participants. They don't feel safe. So what we did, just very quickly, I love the question, so thank you. At the end of January, we had people in small rooms where you could talk with a group of 30 instead of a group of 350. Actually, we had 550 at our first public meeting. You can talk with a group of 30 to 50 with two experts who know everything about air quality or everything about
sound like, I don't know, it's a little inconsistent with my previous message. Two experts who are being paid to do work on transportation and to do work on air quality and noise. And we got a lot of positive feedback because people really did want to learn and get to the bottom. Are you telling me the truth? Help me understand this. I've heard this. Is it right? So there, but there, you cannot remove the full room environment. And then we always give people paper. So if you can't speak up in the group, write it down. It's a part of the official record. And don't have to do it right then. You got 2 weeks after the meeting to do it too. And that all becomes part of the record. So those are the mechanisms, and thank you for asking.
Larry, you wanted to jump in here?
I only ever ran for public office once, and I was elected. And in the process of that, we were going through what was called the four pillars in Vancouver, which was, what do we do about drugs? And when we organized the meetings, the first thing that we all agreed was that there would be no barriers, none. Come one, come all. And so we had public meetings every single night. The mayor, I wasn't mayor at the time, I was chief coroner, but the mayor, the drug czar that we had in the city. And the first meeting I went to, I'm an ex-Mountie, the first meeting I went to, I thought, you know, this could be a really dangerous place to be, because it was packed and people were totally wrapped up in their particular. So the left was here and the right was there. As we went on, the left fell off and the right fell off, and we ended up with a consensus. And it took a long time to do that. But there were lots of people exactly like you, sir, who would, after the meeting, come up to me or come up to the mayor or come up to somebody else to express their opinion for exactly the same reason that you were reticent. And we took that. We noted that, and we made sure that they were included in there. And if you continued to come to the meetings, I would reach out to you. And there was a process that goes on. Public meetings are nasty, nasty business. Believe me. And they're tough.
You've got to come to my meetings.
I know, you see. But, they are tough for many people. Lots of people are perfectly well at them. But if they're organized properly, and as you said, you know, if you can have different groups, if you make that, but when we were starting out, if we'd have had barriers such as tables or anything like that, it would have been a failure. What we did notice is that participation grew in certain areas of the city if we had muffins and juice. And that's okay. Absolutely true. That, you know what, for $100, you could get more than 100 people out there, which was pretty amazing, which also goes to the fact that there are people who are eating properly in our community.
Okay, we've got almost at lunchtime, but we've got time for, I think, one other question here. So, madam, could you proceed, please?
My name is Joanne McDonald. I'm the executive director of the Space for Life Foundation, La Fondation Espace pour la Vie. Social engagement in biodiversity is extremely important to us. There's a study that came out in French media last week that states that corporations and not-for-profit organizations are taking over social media so that they can create citizens' movements, their shells, in fact. Do you think that's true, that we are going towards citizens' movements where more and more people, it's very easy to click a button and be part of a group and so on, but that these are taken over by organizations to sell products or ideas and so on? And if it's true, how can we avoid that?
Anyone like to begin on this one?
I have Denise thoughts. I think it's a bit true. I mean, I think as soon as there is a contentious issue, that the sides that are well organized will definitely get themselves onto social media. There was a quarry that was being proposed in Southern Ontario, I think 2 summers ago now, and both teams were immediately on Twitter and working very, very hard to promote their point of view and their name, especially the name of the company that wanted to dig the quarry was like sort of vague, so you couldn't really tell that it was attached. I find it pretty, I was going to say frightening. I don't know if frightening is really the word, but again, as a media a creator, it's really strange for me that something like 90% of all traffic to everything on the internet is driven by Facebook. Like every single thing. Everything is about Facebook on the internet. And I actually quit Facebook because I couldn't, it was just making me feel strange. How can we avoid it? I guess the thing is that, I don't know, like maybe it gets back to getting people on the streets or maybe it gets back to going door to door. I think what it would be is that for yourself in anything that you're involved in, social media has to be a part of it, but it can never be all of it. And when you see a petition and it has 80,000 signatures and that maybe is exciting or create some emotion in you, to take a step back and think about, do those people even live in Canada, you know? So I think it's definitely true, the corporatization of social media. I don't know exactly how to combat it, but it's definitely something that I think about a lot, and I think everyone should.
And I just a very small follow-up. I totally, I guess I'm consistent with Denise's thoughts, and particularly the point about it can't, in and of itself, it's a tool that supports citizenship, but it's not a problem-solving tool. I mean, you don't really thoughtfully understand different perspectives on a very complicated issue in 140 characters or less in a tweet war, like a Twitter war. Like that's, and this Island Airport thing is kind of obsessing me at the moment, but there's a very effective citywide organization called No Jets TO that's extremely competent on Twitter, as are Ports Toronto, to their credit, really strong social media strategy. But it's not in that venue that we're going to solve the problem about, you know, what we want for our waterfront. So I guess very quickly, it's just, it's not the only, well, yes, it might be sort of discouraging seeing that may coming, that this corporatization may be coming forward as a trend. In and of it, our responsibility then is to put it in its place and create the structures around it that reduce the influence, right? And then have other structures that are more compelling and more effective. That's my suggestion.
Well, I really think that we've had a good time today. At least I have. Before we break for lunch, I'd like to thank everybody on the panel, Larry,
Jay, Nicole.
And before we break for lunch, which is 1 hour, I'm told, we begin
well,
again.
Well, we'd like to be back by 2 and get on schedule, so we'd love if you don't mind.
Your lunch has been shortened. Okay, after that, we have a special presentation from Professor Evelyn Peters, Aboriginal People and the Good Life in Cities. So enjoy your lunch. Bon appétit.
Sideways just to find our friends. Oh,